Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Bruno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of Matthew with The Lord and the Temple Tax. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. The Lord, on coming down from the Mount of Transfiguration, found his nine disciples who had not gone with him up the mountain, unable to cast out a demon from a man's son. The Lord cast them out, but then the disciples were curious. In Matthew 17 and verse 19, then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" So Jesus said to them, "Because of your unbelief. For surely I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." Now, the word impossible here is adunateo. And that A in front, we should recognize that from other words like atheist. You know, a theist is someone who has a god. An atheist is someone who doesn't have a god or claims there's no god anyway. So A makes it negative. And adunateo, we get our word dynamite from that, and it means to have inherent power. So impossible means beyond your inherent power. And the Lord says that if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, nothing will be beyond your inherent power. Now this is explained, I believe, by the one other place this same word adunateo, or impossible, occurs, in Luke 1 and verse 37. "For with God, nothing will be impossible." Now, the fact is that no one could move a mountain on their own. No one could do that. But with God, such a thing is possible. And that's the thing. If God has told you to move a mountain, you can move it. With God, nothing's impossible. Verse 21, "However, this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting." Now, some Greek manuscripts omit this verse, and so some of your translations might not have it in it. However, this verse is contained in the Syriac. What's the Syriac? Well, understand that while the Bible was written in Greek, it very early started to be translated into other languages. And one of those languages was Aramaic, the language that was common in the land of Israel at the time. And the Aramaic translation of the Bible we call the Syriac, since Aramaic originally came from Syria or Assyria. So this was one of the first translations made of the Bible. So it was made using manuscripts older than any Greek manuscripts we currently have. So when a verse is contained in the Syriac, well, that is very strong evidence for that verse. So this verse says, "This kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting." Now he says, "This kind." And that's interesting. Does this indicate that there are different kinds of evil spirits? And we have different names for them in the New Testament. A python spirit, an evil or calamity-causing spirit, a demon, and so forth. And it could be that some of these are not just synonyms, that they actually do name different kinds of evil spirits. So the Lord speaks of this kind. Then he says, "Does not go out except by prayer and fasting." Now, this seems very interesting, and it raises some questions in my mind. For example, I don't read here that the Lord either prayed or fasted before he cast it out, and yet he did cast it out. And I can't help but think if the disciples had still been on their mission that the Lord had sent them on in Matthew 10, where he told them to cast out demons, and he gave them his power to do so, well, I can't help but think that they would have been able to cast this demon out, even without prayer and without fasting. Yet remember what we talked about last time, which was that the disciples had now returned to the Lord, and their commission to cast out demons was done. And so they didn't have the Lord's authority or permission to cast out demons. And perhaps this is what the Lord means. The way you should go about attempting to cast out a demon, when you don't have my specific commission or authority to do so, when you don't have my power given to you, granted to you to do so, is entirely different than when you do have my commission to cast out demons. And what you should do in that case is pray and fast. Now, prayer has to do with seeking God, seeking communion with Him. And fasting has to do with denying yourself. So perhaps what the Lord means is, if instead of just trying to cast out this demon based on an old commission that doesn't apply anymore, if instead you had denied yourselves by fasting and sought communion with God by praying, well, then perhaps God would have answered you and would have allowed you to relieve this boy's condition. But you didn't do that. Instead, you acted like you just inherently had the power to do it, like you didn't need God's help. Like if God let you do it once, you could still do it, kind of like Samson after his hair was cut and thought he could still do powerful acts, which he could do while the Spirit was still with him. But no, that's wrong. Now, fasting is something that's mentioned 8 times in the New Testament. And it is never mentioned after the Acts period has ended. And fasts are generally connected with Israel's religious observance. And in this case, notice the Lord is speaking to his 12, or at least his 9 disciples, all of whom were Israelites, when he tells them to fast. And the Lord never tells Gentiles living in his dispensation of grace to fast. So this is something that's generally connected with Israel. Well, now we have the Lord predicts his death a second time in Matthew 17 and verse 22. Now, while they were staying in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men." So we read that they were staying in Galilee, and the fact is that Galilee is where the Lord lived during his life on earth, or at least during his earthly ministry. Now remember, his hometown where he grew up was Nazareth, and yet he had been forced out of there. We read about that in Luke 4, verses 29 through 30, where it speaks of those of Nazareth, that the inhabitants of Nazareth rose up and thrust him out of the city, and they led him to the brow of the hill on which their city was built, that they might throw him down over the cliff. Then passing through the midst of them, he went his way. So those from his hometown had tried to kill him by throwing him off a cliff. And he had left them, and after this, it seems that he had come to dwell in Capernaum. Matthew 4 and verse 13. And leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is by the sea, in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali. Now, some people have made a big deal out of the verse where the Lord says, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head." And they have claimed that the Lord had no home. He had no house. He had no living place. That he was homeless. And this was especially popular some years ago when there was a big movement to raise awareness of the homeless and the plight of the homeless in the United States, and it became very popular to talk about the homeless. So people at that time latched onto this idea that the Lord was homeless. Well, the thing was that the Lord was a traveling preacher. And as he traveled, he would travel all around Israel, far away from his home. And while he was traveling, while he was out on the road, he often didn't have a place to stay at night. He had to sleep on the street. But that doesn't mean that when he came back home to his own town, he didn't have a house. The Lord was a carpenter, a builder, for goodness sake. He could build himself his own house, and he probably did. He had a house in Capernaum, and the Lord was not homeless. And the things people try to do to bring the Lord in on popular movements, it's kind of ridiculous. The Lord had a house in Capernaum. Now, while they are staying there in Galilee, we read that Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men." And this is actually the second prediction of the Lord's coming suffering and death that he makes to his disciples. And the first prediction we saw back in Matthew 16 and verse 21. "From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day." And we talked about the fact that the Lord various times predicted what was going to come upon him to his disciples. And each time he made a prediction, it seems he revealed more details. Now, the details in this second prediction of his are that he was going to be betrayed, that men would kill him, and the third day he would be raised again. Now, the second and third facts he gives here were announced the first time back in Matthew 16. But the fact that he's going to be betrayed is a new fact, first mentioned here. Now, betrayed is the same Greek word as is used for what Judas did when he betrayed the Lord, and I believe is a direct reference to the fact that Judas was going to betray him. Verse 23, "And they will kill him, and the third day he will be raised up." And they were exceedingly sorrowful. So he reveals the fact that after he is betrayed into the hands of men, he's going to be killed. But this is not going to be permanent. He tells them that on the third day he will be raised up. Now we read that the disciples were exceedingly sorrowful, very, very sorry about this. And it makes sense that they would be sorry that he would have to go through this kind of suffering. And I would say, of course, they shouldn't have wanted him to suffer such things. Why would we wish such things on our glorious Lord? And yet I can't help but notice that sorrow is as far as they go. And it seems that the final glorious fact that he was going to rise from the dead after death never quite sunk in with his disciples. Well, no wonder, because in our experience, death is so final. When someone or something dies, that's the end of it. I mean, just think of even a little bug like a mosquito. I can slap a mosquito and kill it. I can do that. I've done it many times. And yet, even something as small and simple as a mosquito, I can't bring it back to life once I've killed it. My power over life and death only goes in one direction. I can reverse life and bring it to death, but I can't take death and bring it to life. And so no wonder the disciples, when they heard the Lord was going to die, it didn't quite sink in with them that he was going to rise from the dead afterwards. They didn't get it. And yet that was the wonderful, amazing fact. Verse 24, "When they had come to Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, 'Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?'" So they came to Capernaum. In Greek, this is Capharnaum, spelled Capharnaum. And Capharnaum means village of comfort. Now, as far as we know, Capernaum was located on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. And it was in the north, near where the Jordan flows into the Sea of Galilee. And of course, it flows out of it in the south and then flows down to the Dead Sea. But this is up near where it flows into the sea in the north. Now, when they are there in Capernaum, now that means, notice, that they came back to their home, as I already quoted you from Matthew 4 and verse 13. So they came home, basically, and that's where you would look for the Lord when he wasn't out on his journeys. You'd look for him at home. Well, those who took the temple tax collectors came. Now, temple tax in Greek is didrachmon, D-I-D-R-A-C-H-M-O-N. And didrachmon means a double drachma. And a drachma was a coin. And in their coin system, four drachmas made up a shekel. A didrachma was a double drachma, or two drachmas, or half a shekel. And there was a coin that was worth two drachmas. Kind of like we have quarters. Then we have a half dollar that's worth two quarters. And then we even have a dollar coin that's worth a whole dollar. Well, this was a double drachma, a double quarter shekel. Now, it seems that the didrachman was a well-known term for the temple tax, since the temple tax was two drachmas, and so therefore it could be paid by a didrachman, a single didrachman. So they don't say, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" They say, "Does your teacher not pay the didrachma?" But everyone knew that meant the temple tax of two drachma. Now notice the way they say this. "Does your teacher not?" And they seem to imply that they don't think he does. They're challenging Peter that they think the Lord doesn't pay the didrachma. Now these men, being tax collectors for the temple, and therefore being associated with the temple, perhaps had adopted the negative view of the Lord that the religious leaders in charge of the temple had. So maybe that was why they said, "Yeah, that master of yours, scumbag that he is, probably doesn't want to pay the temple tax, does he?" Or maybe they were used to popular teachers acting like well, I'm a popular teacher. I should be above paying the temple tax. And so they lumped the Lord in with them and thought that he wouldn't want to pay. Well, for whatever reason, they seemed to have the view that the Lord wouldn't want to pay the temple tax. Verse 25, he said, yes. And when he had come into the house, Jesus anticipated him, saying, what do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take customs or taxes? From their sons or from strangers? So Peter answers and he says, yes. Yes, my teacher does pay the drachman, the temple tax. However, it seems doubtful to me that Peter had actual knowledge of this. I mean, had Peter actually seen the Lord pay the drachman, the temple tax, before this? Well, I doubt that he had knowledge of whether or not the Lord would pay the temple tax, considering the Lord's statement to him when he got home. And so I would guess that he probably said this because he felt put on the spot. Like, your teacher is some kind of scumbag, and he wanted to defend him. So he said, yes, he does, even though he didn't really know whether he did or not. Now, when he got home, it says that the Lord anticipated him. He probably came home ready to ask the Lord this disturbing question. These tax collectors came to me and accused you of not paying the temple tax. What do you say, Lord? But see, before he could even ask it, before he could even reveal this was on his heart, before he could even open his mouth, the Lord answered his question before he could ask it. And of course, the Lord could do that kind of thing because he was God and he had divine God-given knowledge. Now notice how he anticipated him. He says, what do you think, Simon? And remember, Simon was actually Peter's name given by his parents. Peter was a name the Lord had given to Simon himself. It was his God-given name. But his parents' given name was Simon, and the Lord calls him his parents' given name here. He says, from whom do the kings of the earth take customs or taxes? From their sons or from strangers? Now understand that by sons, the Greek word huios, he doesn't necessarily mean their children. As if they would go around to their kids, hey kids, I need some tax money here, put it in the tax wallet here, give me all your money, kids. No, he's not talking about his children. See, a son, a huios, a son, means a representative. And the sons of the king would be the representatives of the king. They wouldn't have to necessarily be his blood children. They're just his representatives. And his representatives would be his followers, his agents, those whom he had given authority to act on his behalf. Now, a king's agents, his servants, his followers, his sons, would be supported from taxes. Of course, they were working for him, so he would give them their wages, and he would get those wages from the tax money. Now, how could he get the money to pay his followers? By taxing those followers. If the followers were paid from tax money, how would they get money to pay the taxes in order to support themselves? Now, of course, a king doesn't collect taxes from his agents in order to pay his agents. He collects taxes from all the other people in order to pay his agents to do his work. How else would any king maintain his court? How else would he pay his employees, his servants, his workers? Of course he must tax strangers, outsiders. And that's what the word strangers here means, those who are not a part of the king's court. Verse 26, Peter said to him, from strangers. Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. So Peter gives the obvious answer. Of course, kings collect taxes from strangers, from those outside their courts, not from those who are working for him. And the Lord says, well, then the sons are free from the necessity to pay taxes. And of course they were. And yet notice what the Lord's words imply. The Lord is saying this about the temple. And the tax, the drachma tax, that went to support the temple. And yet the Lord implies that this temple tax was his own taxes being collected for his own purposes. But how could that possibly be true unless the Lord himself was the master, owner, and king of the temple? By saying that the temple tax is collected to support my servants, he is basically saying that God's temple is his temple, and he is the king of it. So all the taxes collected on behalf of the temple to support it are being collected for his benefit. Well, who could possibly be in charge of God's temple except God? Who could possibly say, the temple is mine, other than the God for whom the temple was built? And the Lord here shows that he is the God of God's temple. Verse 27, nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. And when you have opened its mouth, you will find a piece of money. Take that and give it to them for me and you. So while the Lord reveals that his sons, his representatives, shouldn't have to pay the temple tax, they're the ones who should be supported from the temple tax, he says, nevertheless, we don't want to offend them. And the word there is scandalizo. It means to scandalize them or to cause them to stumble. So he says, we don't want to cause them to stumble. So he says, you go to the sea, cast in a hook, and this means a small fishing hook, and take the fish that comes up first. And then he's going to open the fish's mouth and find in it a piece of money. Now, the piece of money here is, in Greek, stater, S-T-A-T-E-R. And a stater was a coin equal to a shekel coin. Now, remember I said a drachma is a quarter of a shekel. A didrachma is two drachmas, half a shekel. A stater is a full shekel, so it would be two didrachmas. And he says, this will be for me and you. This is four drachmas, two didrachmas, enough to pay the temple tax, the didrachman, for me and for you, the two of us. Now here we see the Lord using his power, both his power of all knowledge and his power over nature. Now we could well imagine how a coin could drop into the sea. Some traveler is leaning over to pay his fare, having just crossed on a ferry or about to cross on a ferry. And as he's leaning over, he accidentally drops the stater coin he was holding to pay for his ferry and drops it into the sea and it's lost. And then we could imagine a fish swimming along and seeing something shiny on the bottom of the sea and diving down and catching it in his mouth, and here's this stater coin. But what would lead that fish right to Peter's hook right when the Lord said it would be there? And we realize that the Lord ordered it to go there. Perhaps he even ordered the fish to find and take up the coin. And the Lord used his divine power over nature and his power of all knowledge to cause this to come about. And in this way, the Lord provides the temple tax for himself and for Peter. Now, this raises several questions in my mind. One is, where were the other disciples? Why was it okay just to pay the temple tax for the Lord and Peter, but not for the rest of the disciples? We could wonder if they were off somewhere, but it seems the first verse of chapter 18 that they're right there. But consider the symbolism of this. Remember what the Lord had said to Peter in Matthew chapter 4 and verse 19. Then he said to them, follow me and I will make you fishers of men. The Lord had told Peter that he would fish and catch men. Now in this case, Peter fishes, catches a fish, and finds the provision he needs in the fish's mouth. And this teaches Peter that when the time comes and he fishes and catches men, they will provide him with all the living he needs. And at that time, he won't have to worry about providing for himself. Remember Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 9 and verses 4 through 5. When he says of his work as an apostle, do we have no right to eat and drink, that is, at the expense of those we lead? Do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord, and Cephas? And Cephas is the Aramaic name for Peter. And this tells us that Peter and his wife both ate and drank using their authority as apostles. They were supported by those they caught for the Lord. And so the Lord not only took care of his servants while he was with them on earth, but after that, in the Acts period, he took care of them as well. So in this portion, the Lord told his disciples that to have prayed and fasted over the boy whom they couldn't save from the demon, which may mean they should have sought God's will and denied themselves. He returns home to Galilee and predicts once again his coming death and resurrection. When Peter was questioned about the temple tax, the Lord revealed that he is the king of the temple, and so wouldn't need to pay the tax. And yet, in order not to offend the tax collectors, he told Peter to go and get the money for both of them from the mouth of a fish. Later, Peter would fish for men and get his support from those he caught for God. Well, let those of us who serve God trust him that he'll watch over us, even as he did his disciples.
What a beautiful story that shows Christ not being subject to the temple tax, as he is God himself. Nevertheless, not wanting to offend, he pays it by exercising divine knowledge and control over the situation and over nature itself. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the Lord and the temple tax. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Matthew with Greatest in the Kingdom. Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that the more you study God's Word, the more you know and love God. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. This program has been brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry. Please visit seedandbread.org. I've been your host, Bob Juneau, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. We'll say so long for now, but we always look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.